second. So the hyperinflation theory doesn't last very long. But it is enough to cause the universe to be in thermal contact. And by the way, life is only possible if the universe is thermally connected. If it's not thermally connected, there's no possibility for life. Yes. Oh, what large was the universe when all this took place? Well, before the hyperinflation began, the universe was smaller than a fundamental particle, smaller than a proton or an electron. And by the time the hyperinflation was over, it was about the size of a grapefruit. Okay, so it went from the size of a little tiny particle to the size of a grapefruit in about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. Now, that may not sound like much, but it works out to be many thousands of times the velocity of light to get it to grow that fast. And by the time it's the size of a grapefruit, you get everything thermally connected, and then everything's nice thereafter. Yes. Well, yeah, for a brief instant, a nuclear bomb explosion is incredibly rapid, and then it gets slowed down by the stuff it bumps into, like buildings and human beings, etc. So, but what we're talking about here is something slightly different. There's nothing outside slowing down the expansion of the universe. And so given that there's nothing to slow it down, it will expand at the same rate. But what happens is, slightly after the beginning of the expansion, you've got the separation of forces of physics that allows for this extremely rapid hyperinflation to take place. And by the way, without this hyperinflation, none of us would be here. And a hyperinflation must be extraordinarily fine-tuned for life to be possible. Cliff. Yes, that's true, that galaxies form with stars forming and clusters, and the clusters of stars merge together to make mini-galaxies, and the mini-galaxies merge together to make big galaxies. And that merging process is still going on, although at a much slower rate than what took place. By the way, I'm going to get you to something about the first stars here. But the thing I want to get you to, and this is the first time this has been able to be done, we can now apply an observational test to whether or not the inflationary hot Big Bang model is right or whether or not it's wrong. Now, if there's no inflation, something called the secular spectral index will be greater than 1. And actually, it's not as complicated as it sounds, so I'll explain it to you. And if there is inflation, it would be slightly less than 1. And if it's simple inflation, and simple inflation is the model I just described for you, where you got the forces of physics separating, you got this brief period of hyper expansion where it expands at that rate, then you would get this secular spectral index coming in, scalar spectral index coming in at 0.95. So those are the numbers. And the thing is, with the WMAP, for the first time, we can measure this scalar spectral index. You say, what is a scalar spectral index? Well, what astronomers can do in looking at the map is they look at the big spots, big cold and hot spots, relative to the small spots. And if it's an inflationary model, we would predict that the temperature differences between big cold spots and big hot spots will be greater than the temperature differences between small hot spots and small cold spots. And until a few days ago, we simply didn't have the accuracy of the radiation from the creation event to actually make that kind of measurement. Well, the first time in history, we can make that measurement and therefore test whether or not it's an inflationary hot Big Bang model, and if so, what kind. Well, let me get you back to the results. Okay, if no inflation, then that index would have to be greater than 1. If there is inflation, it'll be very slightly less than 1. And if it's the simplest inflation model, it'll be exactly 0.95. Well, the second release of the WMAP tells us it's 0.951 plus or minus 0.017. And this is what generated all the excitement in the scientific community about this research study. Because for decades, we've been wanting to put the inflationary model to a direct observational test. Now we can do it. And I'd say, what's the big deal about all this for philosophers and theologians and Christians? Well, the big deal is that the simple inflationary model is very compatible with a biblical cosmic creation model. It's the model that says there's a beginning of space and time. You got the universe expanding from the beginning of space and time in such a way that it produces galaxies, stars, and planets. And it tells us that there must be a causal agent beyond space and time that creates the universe, and a causal agent that designs the universe in such a way that we wind up with the just right kinds of stars, galaxies, and planets. So this is a really big deal for those of us who belong to the Christian faith. I think this is going to be perhaps the biggest discovery of 2006 in giving us more evidence for the Christian faith. It's also something I'm going to be able to use in this forum next Saturday, because the young Earth creationist model predicts there's no inflation. The old Earth creation model predicts that there would be inflation. And now we have this result that tells us, hey, the no inflation model is wrong. It's not more than 1.0 with very high confidence. It can't be more than 1.0, and it really looks like it fits beautifully a simple inflation model. Yes. Yeah, the basis for what made this test possible is that we now had a detailed enough map of the radiation left over from the creation event that we could actually look at the temperature differences between big spots and small spots and see if there's anything distinctive. With the first release, it simply wasn't good enough to do that. This is the WMAP second release, 3 years worth of data from the satellite. And so now we've got enough detail that we can actually make these kinds of measurements. Whereas ground-based measurements, we couldn't do it. And even with the first release of the WMAP, there wasn't enough data there to allow us to make this test. Well, NASA funded the satellite. They were the ones that put the satellite in orbit. And it's mainly a team of American and Canadian astronomers that worked on this data. And, you know, in reading this paper, I can tell you, it was a nightmare analyze the data. I mean, they had this enormous pile of stuff, and they had to very accurately remove all the confusing aspects, like the radiation from our galaxy, the radiation from nearby discrete sources, galaxies and pulsars and so forth. They had to take all that out, and you know, that's what took them so long. I mean, they are 2.5 years late in releasing this. But in reading the paper, I can tell you why. I mean, they just had this tremendous pile of data, and they had to find some way to analyze it so that they could get the pristine information out from what the WMAP had there for them. But the good news is the third release is going to go much more smoothly, because now they've worked out all the problems in analyzing the data, so when they do the third release, it's going to be much faster. And the third release, we'll be able to prove once and for all that it's an inflationary model and exactly what kind. Because the next release, they're going to get 10 times more sensitivity than what you see here. So that's going to be really exciting. Yeah. Well, young Earth creationists have been embarrassed by what's called the light travel time problem. And the light travel time problem is the fact that we see galaxies, you know, 11, 12 billion light years away. And the velocity of light, we can prove, is constant, at least since this inflationary episode. And so if the velocity of light is constant, that means it took 12 billion years for that light to travel from that object to our telescope. Now, the young Earth's response to that is to say, well, the old Earth creationists also have a light travel time problem. And the light travel time problem they're referring to is, how can the universe be thermally connected if indeed the velocity of light is constant? Well, the answer to that is that you have this period of inflation, which connects everything when the universe is less than a trillionth of a trillionth of 100 thousandths of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. Then it's all nicely thermally connected. And so they wind up denying inflation as a way to say, well, we have a problem, but you guys have a problem. And what this does is show that there's no problem for the old Earth model, but the problems for the young Earth model remain. There is no solution in their model for the light traveling across large distances of space. And if you want to read about it, I go into that in some detail in my book, A Matter of Days. But yeah, the way they've always gotten out of that is to say, well, yeah, we got problems, but you got problems too. Well, they can't say that anymore. Exactly. Simple inflation is it solves the problem of how is it that the universe is thermally connected. Yeah, it solves that problem, and it also fits very beautifully with the unified field theory. So now we know we got, you know, more experimental evidence that the unified field theory is right. Now we had some experimental evidence even before this, but not for the strong nuclear force. With these powerful particle accelerators like exist in Chicago and outside Geneva, we're able to duplicate the temperature conditions of the universe when you had electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force blending together. So that can be done inside a particle accelerator. But you need a particle accelerator about 4 miles long to be able to do that. Now, to get the energy to be able to do it for the strong nuclear force, to use a particle accelerator to actually duplicate the unification of the strong nuclear force, the electroweak force, you need a particle accelerator 40 trillion miles long. And as particle physicists have said, that's not going to happen until the Democrats get control of both the executive branch and the Congress. That won't get funded. Okay, in terms of implications for the creator, this was called a problem for Big Bang cosmology. Okay, in other words, if inflation is wrong, then Big Bang cosmology faces a problem. How do you get galaxies and stars if the universe indeed starts from a creation event, an actual creation of matter, energy, space, and time? And given that we must have the universe thermally connected for life, how do we put that off? And they said, you know, the standard Big Bang model can't explain that, because the standard Big Bang model has no inflation. Now, by the way, there are other ways besides inflation to keep the universe thermally connected, but they involve exotic and appeals to exotic geometry, like saying that there are 5 large dimensions of space instead of just 3. And there's zero experimental evidence that would say that there's these extra dimensions. We know there are extra dimensions of a small size, 6 extra small space dimensions, but we have no evidence that there's these big ones. But if you had the big ones, theoretically, you could solve it that way without inflation. But it's an appeal to something very complicated, whereas this is, you know, Occam's razor, the simplest solution. Yeah. Okay, thermal connectivity simply means that every part of the universe influences every other part of the universe. And so, I mean, you can think of an oven analogy. When you've got an oven, what's going on in one part of the oven influences what's going on in another part of the oven because it's all thermally connected, and that's how you get your turkey to come out at the same temperature all the way across the turkey. But if you had, a second oven separated by an airspace, it would only be thermally connected if indeed you had both ovens extremely hot and close enough together that heat could flow from one to the other, so that temperature changes in one oven can influence temperature changes in another oven. And that's what the universe looks like. As we look at the universe, we see that it's thermally connected. And as you point out, the thermal connection implies that we live in a very homogeneous universe where indeed the temperature differences are only like one part in 100,000. Okay, because of the size of the current universe. The universe is so large that if there wasn't any inflation, parts of the universe that are very far from us would be driven past that point of thermal connection. However, if you've got a period of hyperexpansion, the thermal connectivity that was there in the beginning remains 14 billion years later. Otherwise, it doesn't. Right, but it becomes colder and colder. The same, I mean, no matter where you go in the universe measures the same temperature. That's what thermal connectivity tells us. And the only way you can measure the same temperature is if stuff was rapidly spread out in the universe. Yeah, you got to follow it? Okay, get you back on track there. Okay, you start off with this very hot universe, and what you want to do is get to the universe that's the size it is today, because the present size of the universe, how far apart the galaxies are and the stars are, will be critical for life. If the stars are too far apart, life won't be possible because you won't be able to get the collection of heavy elements to make advanced life, but if the stars are too close together, then the gravitational interaction of one star and another will disturb the formation of a planet, or even if a planet forms, will disturb the orbit. So it's necessary that the universe of today have a certain density of matter. You don't want the matter to be too dense, but you don't want it to be, it's got to be just, you know, not too high, not too low. So that's one constraint. The universe of today has got to be a certain size with the matter spread out to a certain degree. But it also must be thermally connected, which means there needs to be some way to start from a hot spot and get the universe to the size that it is today with everything staying in contact with one. One way to do this is expand it very rapidly. Go back to the oven analogy. You got two ovens that are separated from one another. Now, if you got one oven and you push it apart very fast, it'll stay the same temperature. You push it apart very slowly, that's not going to happen. Does that help? You're getting there. Well, maybe. Okay. Yes. Each one will get better. Right. Well, I'm going to show you some slides where we can do that. You can't do that with this stuff, because what you're getting here with these cosmic background radiation maps is a snapshot of the universe when atoms first formed. And what we're getting are more and more detailed looks at that moment in cosmic history. Now, there's other techniques we can use to see what the universe looks like after that moment and see whether or not it's consistent with an inflationary hot Big Bang. And I got a couple of slides where I'll actually show you how you can see that taking place. Yes. Well, how you get past the speed of light limitation is recognizing that Einstein's special theory of relativity tells us nothing can be accelerated past the velocity of light in a vacuum in the absence of a dark energy term. And that's what happened in 1999. Astronomers were able to prove that the universe is dominated by dark energy. And the principle there is dark energy stretches the space fabric of the universe. And the universe is kind of like a balloon. We're all on the surface of the universe. Although the analogy breaks down because our surface is three dimensions, whereas the balloon's surface is two dimensions. But the whole point is physics tells us you can expand that surface as fast as you want. You can expand it a million times faster than the velocity of light. And what happens is different objects on that surface will be spread apart as a result of that dark energy at greater than the velocity of light. Now, the universe today is expanding at just under the velocity of light. And in the future, it will expand greater than the velocity of light because the space surface is continuing to expand at a faster and faster rate as a result of this dark energy. Okay. Well, let me show you a couple more tests. Yes. Okay. If you don't have the universe thermally connected, it'll be too clumpy. And if it's too clumpy, you're going to get these giant black holes forming everywhere, and that can really mess up your day. So, You know, they just start sucking in everything, and their gravity starts disrupting everything. And so, thermal connectivity keeps the universe homogeneous and uniform. And if it's too homogeneous and uniform, you get no stars forming at all. If it's not homogeneous and uniform enough, then all you get are black holes. And so if all you got are black holes, there's no possibility for atoms or molecules. And so that's probably the most fundamental reason why you want it thermally connected. But yeah, if you expand it really rapidly, that'll keep things thermally connected. But you only have to have a very brief period of thermal, of rapid expansion to make that happen. So yeah, inflation solves a lot of problems, and now we have measurements that tell us that the inflation is right. The other big deal from the second release of the WMAP is a confirmation of what's called Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And you say, what's that all about? Well, the universe starts off infinitely hot. And being infinitely hot, there is no such thing as elements in the universe. It's too hot for there even to be protons and neutrons. But as the universe expands, it cools enough. By the time the universe is, a millionth of a billionth of a second old, you get protons and neutrons forming. And these protons and neutrons can come together to make things like helium and lithium and iron and copper and all that good stuff. Well, as the universe cools from the creation event, you get a brief window of time, only 20 seconds long, when you get the hydrogen bomb working. Now, if you know anything about nuclear weaponry, a hydrogen bomb fuses hydrogen into helium, and it does it when the temperature is above 17 billion degrees centigrade. But if it gets above 100 billion degrees centigrade, it doesn't work. So somewhere between 17 billion and 100 billion is when this fusion can work. Well, there's a 20-second window of time when the universe is that temperature, when it's cooler than 100 billion degrees, and it's hotter than 17 billion degrees. And that happens when the universe is about 3 minutes old. But by the time between 3 minutes and 3.5 minutes after the creation event is when you're going to get this hydrogen being fused into helium. But that's as far as you go. The universe cools so rapidly that you get nothing besides helium. And by the time this 20 seconds is over, the universe is about 75% hydrogen and 25% helium. Now, it turns out the amount of helium you get is an extraordinarily sensitive test for Big Bang cosmology. So, you know, and that's one of the tests. Do we live in a universe that's traceable back to an actual beginning of space-time, matter, and energy, where you've got the supernatural agent beyond space-time, matter, and energy that creates it? Okay, what we were able to do with the WMAP is, based on Big Bang cosmology, predict what's called the primordial helium abundance. This would be the abundance of helium in the universe before stars start burning, before they start making helium and making carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, etc. Well, what we were able to do is come up with a very accurate prediction based on the WMAP of what that primordial helium abundance should be, namely 0.24815 plus or minus 0.00033. Very accurate result. And that would be 24.815% of all the ordinary matter in the universe should be helium. Okay, how does that compare with observations we make of stars that we know are very close to being newborn? The answer is 0.24, let me get the next one up here. Here it is. Okay, 0.24815, and what we observe is 0.249 plus or minus 0.009. So you can see the remarkable fit between what we predict based on the Big Bang creation model and what we actually observe. And my fellow astronomers look at this as the strongest confirmation that we live in a Big Bang universe with a causal agent beyond space, time, matter, and energy. It's the most definitive test that we can make for that. But I can tell you, thanks to the WMAP second release, this test is 10 times more precise than it was before March 16. Now, there's a third test that we've been able to perform for the first time. It's called the quintessence test. This is I don't know where astronomers come up with these words, but they do. When we discovered dark energy, there were a number of astronomers that said, we simply can't accept these dark energy results. Why? Because it points to a supernatural creator. And that's what we saw back in 1999, that the universe is dominated by dark energy in order to explain how life could possibly exist anytime, anywhere in the universe. It was now necessary to fine-tune the value of the constant governing dark energy to better than 1 part in 10 to the 120th. That's 120 zeros after the 1. Although there's British astronomers are saying it's less than 1 part in 10 to the 240, with 240 zeros. Whether it's 240 zeros or 120 zeros, this still ranks as the most spectacular evidence we have anywhere in all the sciences for supernatural, superintelligent design. I mean, this is where the intelligent design debate is won, hands down. And I say, how so? Well, the best example I can give you of human engineering design is 1 part in 10 to the 23. This is 10 to the 97 times superior to the best that we human beings can manifest, which means that the creator of the universe, at a minimum, is 10 to the 97 times smarter than we are, 10 to the 97 times more knowledgeable, 10 to the 97 times better funded than we are. I mean, you can go on with these kinds of arguments. And the recognition of that caused a number of astronomers to say, well, this won't do. Now, they quickly recognized that we can't get rid of dark energy. We now have 9 independent proofs that dark energy dominates the universe. However, they said, how about if we have the dark energy vary instead of being a constant? And actually, this doesn't work well for them. I've written about this in The Creator and the Cosmos, how, you know, if you do that, you certainly reduce the level of design downward from 1 part in 10 to 120. You can get it down to say, well, we don't need such a supernatural, superintelligent creator. But the flaw in that line of reasoning is, in order to get that design down, then you have to put a new design for the variation term. But sometimes that's overlooked. But what we've been able to do with the WMAP is prove whether or not the dark energy parameter is constant. Okay, if quintessence exists, then what's called the W parameter would not be equal to 1. In fact, it'll differ a long ways from 1. It'll be very different from 1. But if dark energy indeed is constant, it will be 1. It'll be exactly 1. Or it's going to be very close to 1. But if it's not varying, it's going to be a long ways from 1. Well, here's the answer. Thanks to the WMAP, we know it's 0.97 plus or minus 0.08. That's so close to 1.0, it means that there can't be any significant variation, there can't be any significant quintessence, and therefore, we really are stuck with this creator that's 10 to the 97 times minimum, smarter, more intelligent, more creative, and more powerful than we human beings. Now, I saw a hand go up somewhere, yes. Okay. The cosmological constant is this idea that dark energy indeed is constant, which means that as the universe expands, we're going to have the same density of the stretching factor per cubic centimeter. And that's why, according to dark energy, as the universe gets older and older, it expands at a more and more rapid rate. Because then, you know, as the universe gets bigger, you've got more cubic centimeters, but every cubic centimeter has got exactly the same amount of dark energy in it. So that's what accelerates the expansion of the universe, according to dark energy. Quintessence says that's wrong, that it's not exactly the same. As the universe gets older and older, we find that the density of dark energy will either go up or go down. And by making it go up and go down, they can reduce that extraordinary level of fine-tuning design. Instead of being 1 part in 10 to the 120th, they can get it down to about 1 part in 10 to the 90th. It doesn't really help them that much in terms of theology. And as I mentioned, by reducing that design, they wind up having to stick in design somewhere else. In particular, you find you have to design the degree of variation. You're actually introducing a second constant. You would have this constant plus a constant that governs the variation of that constant. And whatever design you wind up getting rid of, you've got to introduce that and usually more than the extra constant you throw in. Now, that's not the only way it's done. Another way that quintessence is introduced is to say, forget dark energy, we're going to claim the velocity of light changes. And if the velocity of light changes, that means that the universe's expansion behavior will look the same way as if the velocity of light was constant and this dark energy thing was constant. So, and these are all called quintessence. Quintessence is kind of a label for anything that gets around constant dark energy. So anything that avoids constant dark energy is called quintessence, whatever it is. But all of them involve postulating some kind of variation in at least one of the fundamental constants of physics. And what this result tells us is, hey, don't go there. This proves that dark energy really is constant, at least to this degree. Right. Yeah, no, that's exactly what it is. They say, we don't know what this is, but we do know that it compensates for a varying dark energy parameter. But this is basically telling us we don't need quintessence. And we don't need quintessence, and we really are stuck with this simple demonstration of supernatural, superintelligent design. So, we got two major things to thank the WMAP second release for. Some other things that come out of this, I want to get into our study, so let's see if we can get through this. We now have an accurate date for when the first stars form. Someone here asked about the first stars. When do the first stars form? Well, the first release said roughly 200 million years after the creation event, but it was rough. The second release now gives us an accurate date for when the first stars form, 365 million years after the cosmic creation event. And this has been a tremendous source of relief for the astronomers, because they were looking at that 200 million year date and saying, we really have to push things in order for that to be consistent with all the other observations we have about the deep history of the universe. This 365 million years is beautifully consistent with all the other observations we have about the formation of the first star. So this really tightens things up nicely. In terms of the density parameters, thanks to the WMAP second release, we now know that the dark energy makes up 74% of the total stuff of the universe. When I say total stuff, it's the sum total of all the matter and energy of the universe. So 74% of it is this dark energy. 22% of it is what we call exotic dark matter. Those are additives, so I mean, this whole list adds up to 100%. So yeah, dark energy is 74%, exotic dark matter is 22%, and ordinary matter, what's called the baryon density, is 4.2%. And baryons are protons, neutrons, and electrons. It's the stuff we're all used to. We call it ordinary matter. Exotic dark matter are particles that do not interact well with radiation. Protons, neutrons, and electrons have the property that they efficiently interact with photons, which is why you can actually see these stars and galaxies, because they interact with photons, you see the light. Exotic dark matter does not emit light, and that's why we call it dark. And it's exotic in that it doesn't interact with the photons, and these are things like neutrinos, axions, and neutralinos, although we've only been able to detect the neutrinos. And in terms of neutrinos, the WMAP tells us that the mass of the light neutrinos is less than about one electron volt. You say, well, what on earth is an electron volt? Well, it's a way that physicists use to measure the mass of particles. To give you a point of comparison, a proton comes in at about a billion electron volts. So we're talking about a particle that weighs a little less than a billionth of a proton. So yeah, these are what they call very low mass particles. And they don't interact, and so while you're sitting here in class, thousands of neutrinos blast through your body, and they don't do anything to you. Thank God that they don't. But the other thing that WMAP can tell us is that, you know, in terms of low-mass particles that are neutral, you've got the photon, and you've got three different kinds of light neutrons, neutrinos. And until the WMAP came along, all we could tell was that the number of other light particles, very low mass particles that are neutral without a charge, had to be less than 17. We now know that it's 3 or less. So we've been able to eliminate 14 possible candidates for this exotic matter. Now, someone over here asked a question, what does the universe look like as we go forward from this moment when atoms first form? Well, here's a little chart I can show you. I don't know how well this shows up. But what this is a measure of the temperature of the radiation from the creation event as we look back in time. The map that I showed you at the beginning is how that radiation looks all around us today. But as we look at gas clouds and distant galaxies that are, say, 5 billion light years away, we're measuring what that radiation looks like at that point in cosmic history. Okay, when the universe began, that temperature was infinitely hot. Today, it measures 2.725 degrees above absolute zero. And as we look at gas clouds farther and farther away from us, you can see the temperature goes from 2.725 up to a little more than 3, and the biggest measurement we got puts it at about 12.1 degrees above absolute zero. Now, this gives us a beautiful confirmation of Big Bang cosmology in the sense that that curve you see through there is what you would predict if the universe was created 13.7 billion years ago with an actual beginning of matter, energy, space, and time. And then those measurements are actual observations. So it shows us that the observations do indeed match very well what we would predict from Big Bang cosmology. So this is considered an independent proof that the universe indeed must have begun infinitely hot. It's not our best proof, but I submit this is probably the easiest proof for a layperson to understand. I mean, you're actually watching the universe get hotter and hotter and hotter as you look farther and farther back, farther and farther away, and hence farther and farther back in time. Yes. The two little chandeliers there are what are called upper limits. In other words, we're looking at a gas cloud where we couldn't determine, all we know is that it can't be hotter than that. Okay? I mean, we have no idea how much colder it could be. And the others are actual measurements where you've got pretty decent error bars. Yes. How do they take those measurements? As they look at what are called carbon 4 lines in these distant gas clouds. And the width and the strength of those carbon 4 lines is directly dependent on the temperature of the radiation left over from the creation event. So what that tells you is how hot that cosmic background radiation measured in that distant gas cloud, and the gas cloud is 10 billion light years away, that tells you what that cosmic background radiation temperature was 10 billion years ago. And so again, it starts off infinitely hot. Today it's a little less than 3 degrees above absolute zero. As you look back in time, it should be somewhere in between. And Big Bang cosmology says it would fit precisely that curve, and that's what we see. Yes. Yeah, it'll continue to cool, but as you can see, it levels off to a point where it cools very, very slowly. So we're in that period of very, very slow cooling. By the way, there's some data points very close to the present. We're only looking back, about 0.5 billion years ago. And it comes in like a 2.934, but it's right on the money. I mean, it's like to 4 decimal places. It fits exactly what Big Bang cosmology would predict. And the point there is, when you're looking at something that's, say, 0.5 billion light years away, you can measure with great precision. When you're looking at something that's 12 billion light years away, you notice the error bar gets a lot bigger, just because you can't measure it as accurately as we want to. Yes. Right. 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 Okay. What you have in Genesis chapter 1 are these 6 creation days when God creates, and then you've got the 7th day when he rests. And one way we know that these days must be long time periods is we're still in that 7th day. There's no evening and morning for the seventh day, because we're still in it. It's not finished yet. And it doesn't end until God conquers evil. So the fact that evil exists tells us we're still in the seventh day. And an eighth day is coming when God will create again. But he's not going to create again until evil is first conquered. And so ever since God created Eve, we've been in the seventh day. And we can also confirm that by noticing that when we look in the animal and plant kingdom, we don't see any speciation events. There hasn't been one speciation event since Eve was created. But before Eve, as we look on the fossil record, we can see evidence for about a billion speciation events. Those are the 6 days. Now your question is this, how long are each of those days? Well, the way it's structured in the original Hebrew, the days are consecutive. But they don't have to be equivalent periods of time. In other words, the Hebrew would allow the possibility that day one could be significantly longer than, say, day four. Now, they would all be much longer, of course, than a 24-hour period. But some days, for example, could be half a billion years long. Other days may be only 50 million years long. But they are consecutive. And these 6 days, at least in the way I read Genesis 1, would begin when God is hovering over the surface of the waters of the planet and he's working to create life in the oceans. And so in our model, the first creation day begins about 3.8 billion years ago and takes us up to the present. And that's based on what you see in Genesis 1-2. Well, when it says God created the heavens and the earth, that's actually a compound Hebrew noun. Heavens and earth is a lot like our word butterfly. We take the word butter, attach it to the word fly, and it means something very different than either fly or butter. Likewise, the Hebrew word for heaven has three different definitions. The Hebrew word for earth has five different definitions. But when you take heavens plural and attach it to earth singular, like heavens and earth, that takes on a ninth definition. And that definition means the entire physical creation, all the matter, all the energy, all the space, and all the time. And when it says God created, it uses the word bara, which means to bring into existence something that never existed before. And this is what's so critical about Big Bang cosmology. Big Bang cosmology tells us there's an actual beginning of matter, energy, space, and time with a causal agent beyond that. That's exactly what the first verse of the Bible tells us. In the beginning, God created, brand new, something that didn't exist before, all of physical reality. Okay, so that explains why they're giving all this stuff here this morning. This really is important. Okay, but let me give you another. Yeah, go ahead. I personally would interpret the fifth creation day as beginning with the Cambrian explosion. So 543 million years ago, and that might help you figure what the days are like. You know, you can actually look at some details in the text and figure it out. And by the way, I would say the best way to get those time details is to look at Genesis 1 and compare it with Job 38 and 39, Psalm 104, and Proverbs 8. Those are three other texts that actually take you through the Genesis 1 creation events and gives you enough detail that you can start putting dates on this stuff. Okay, now, let me give you a highly visual way of observing the expansion of the universe from the creation event. This is a cluster of galaxies 2 billion light years away. And this is what the universe looks like about 12 billion light years away. So this is 12 billion years ago, because it took light 12 billion years to reach us. And this one. The other thing you notice was when you look at these galaxies, they all seem to be very symmetrical. And they're basically elliptical galaxies. Now, when you see things on PBS, they like to show you these spiral galaxies like our Milky Way galaxy. But I want to tell you, they're the minority. 94% of all the galaxies we see in the universe today are like these. They're elliptical galaxies, which means that the galaxies have basically collapsed into a huge ball of stars. And the stars have aged so much so that they're now yellow in color instead of blue or green or deep red in color. So yellow is a sign of extreme age. It means the stars are nearing the end of their burning cycle. And if you want an analogy, think of what it's like to burn a log on a fire. As a log burns in the fire, the longer it burns, you see colors taking changes of colors in that fire, just like you do with stars. Yeah. The elliptical galaxies are inhospitable for life because the stars are jammed much too closely together. The thing I'm trying to point out to you here is that these galaxies look very symmetrical. They look old in terms of their color, and they tend to be predominantly these spherical or elliptical galaxies. Whereas if we go back to here, we don't see very many elliptical galaxies. The universe isn't old enough yet to produce any of these. And by the way, what we're looking at here is just 1/10 of a moon diameter across the sky. So this is a very, pardon me, it's much smaller than that. This is 1/10 of 1/10. So this is 1% of a moon diameter. It's a very tiny part of the sky, whereas this is a rather large part of the sky. So in actual fact, what we see here are galaxies that are very far apart, and then here are galaxies jammed together. Now here's some details that are going to break out for you. Okay, these are from the cluster of galaxies 2 billion light years away. You can see that they're symmetrical. And by the way, this one here, you can very faintly see spiral arms in that middle one. But it's set in a latter stage of that spiral galaxy development. All spiral galaxies, if you leave them alone long enough, will collapse into spherical or ellipsoidal systems. So you can see this is on the way towards that kind of collapse. It's getting close to that phase, whereas the other ones are already there. But they're symmetrical, and the one on the right shows you that they're far apart. They're far enough apart that the galaxies are not disturbing one another. Now, 12 billion light years away, you can see that the galaxies have very young features. There's no symmetry there. The spiral arms are still forming. And the one on the right, you can see the galaxies are jammed so tightly together that they're actually ripping one another apart. They're stealing spiral arms away from one another, and it's causing explosions in that bottom left galaxy. And so that's a very easy way to see the universe growing up from the creation event. Obviously, it's much younger, farther away. The galaxies are jammed much more tightly together, and the symmetry hasn't had time to develop, and the stars haven't been around long enough to get this deep yellow color that you see there. Okay, believe it or not, this is all I was going to tell you about the WMAP, and I naively thought I could get through this in about 5 minutes. So, but I thank you for your interest and your questions. Those have been great questions. One more. Well, this right here is a very tiny piece of what's called the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. It's the only photograph we have at optical wavelengths that takes you sufficiently far back in time. You're looking at the very first galaxy. So it's deep enough that we can see all the galaxies that are to see in this tiny window of the sky. And if we assume that the rest of the universe is similar to this piece, and that's a relatively good assumption based on the WMAP, if it's thermally connected, then everywhere you look in the universe, it's got to look virtually the same as this. So all you got to do is count all the galaxies in this one piece of the sky, and that tells you how many galaxies exist in the entire universe. Oh yeah, it's been done. I'll give you the number. But the number I'm going to give you are for what are called the medium-sized, large, and giant galaxies. This is not deep enough to show us all the dwarf galaxies 12 billion light years away. And dwarf galaxies are probably 90% of the total number of galaxies in the universe. Okay, but just looking at the big ones and the medium-sized ones, it adds up to 1/4 trillion galaxies in the whole universe. So if you want to throw in all the tiny galaxies, you can multiply that by 10. So that would be about 2.5 trillion galaxies. Well, yeah, it's a little bit complicated in the sense that as the universe gets older and older, galaxies tend to merge together, and therefore you wind up with fewer galaxies than what you had in the beginning. On the other hand, as in this particular early stage of the universe, the galaxies are ripping one another apart, which means that you get some big galaxies being split apart into 3 or 4 components, sort of the multiplication factor as well as the subtraction factor. But they said, let's just forget all that and just do a simple count. If you do a simple count, it's a quarter of a trillion. But then, you know, we need to fine-tune this a little bit more with more images like this. Yes. Well, one reason, I mean, when you look at galaxies in what's called the local group, you get a distorted view of the universe. Because our local group has only 24 members. Most clusters of galaxies have over 10,000 members. And most clusters of galaxies, I mean, this is kind of a typical cluster of galaxies. It looks like this. Thousands of galaxies jammed fairly tightly together. Whereas our cluster of galaxies has only 24 members, and they're spread very far apart. And because they're spread very far apart, the spiral structure can be sustained for a much longer period of time. So in our local group, three of them are spiral galaxies. Three of the 25 are spiral galaxies. Whereas what's typical in the universe is that only 6% are spiral galaxies. And we have no elliptical galaxies in our local group. We have dwarf galaxies and spiral galaxies. Highly unusual, but that's exactly what you need for life. I mean, all you got to do is throw in one of these big elliptical galaxies, and you can kiss the possibility of life goodbye for the local group. And the other thing that's really critical is that they be far apart. And it's also critical that our local group be a long ways from a big cluster of galaxies, which it is. So this is all part of the design. Okay, a couple more questions, and we're going to wrap it up. And I'm not going to get to my Psalm 19. Well, I don't know whether I ever said this in the class here. There's three verses in Job 38 where God asks the question, do you know where darkness resides? Where does it live? And, of course, the five scientists that were assembled there said, we have no clue. And until a few months ago, we would have had to say the same thing. We now know what the darkness is, where it resides. And discovering what it is and where it resides, we've uncovered the most spectacular evidence for supernatural design. There's a good question why God asked that in Job 38. The answer to that question proves his existence and his handiwork more spectacularly than anything else we can look at in science. And I use that as an example of how God inspires these prophets and apostles to record material that's for a future generation. You know, Peter said that in his letter. He says, you know, these prophets of long ago longed to understand what the Holy Spirit was inspiring them to write, but had to be content was for a future generation. And, of course, a lot of that context is they were writing about the coming Messiah and really didn't understand what all this stuff meant. Well, the scriptures are loaded with a lot of material beyond just the revelation of Christ, but the revelation of what he wants us to see in these last days. A third of the Bible is prophecy about last days human existence. This is one example of one that's been fulfilled right in the last several months. But yeah, it's critically important that the universe be 99.73% dark stuff and only 0.27% stuff that we can see. If it isn't, you and I wouldn't be here talking to one another. So, yeah. Which one do you want? That one. Right. The light has, yeah. I mean, where are they relative to one another today? Well, and that depends exactly what kind of model or geometry you have for the universe. And so the favored model for the universe tells us that the dimensions of the universe are 168 billion light years across. But because we're looking back in time, you can only look back to the creation event, which means you're only going to get to see 13.73 billion light years of that extent of the universe. The universe we see is very different from the universe that exists today. Because the universe we see is the universe of the past. And the universe of the past is much smaller than the universe of today. But you can look at the universe of the past, and depending what kind of geometry you apply to that universe, you can see how big the universe is today, and consequently how far apart these galaxies would be if we were looking at them today. Much farther apart than what we see here. Okay, now, well, that 2.5 trillion would be if you assume that we have 10 times as many galaxies that we can't see as the galaxies that we do see. And that's still kind of a fertile field of astrophysical research, exactly how many dwarf galaxies exist at different points in cosmic history. One thing we do know, unless the population of dwarf galaxies is extremely high, there's no way to keep a spiral galaxy spiral for more than 10 billion years. Our galaxy stays spiral by eating dwarf galaxies at a rate of about one every half billion or billion years. And if it eats them too fast, you get into problems. If it doesn't eat them fast enough, you get into problems. And you also get into problems if you've got, say, a spoiled galaxy that's disrupting the consumption of dwarf galaxies. But yeah, this is kind of an ongoing area of research. How many of these dwarfs do we need? What kinds of dwarfs do we need? Because the dwarfs come in three different kinds. And so, talk to me 3 years from now, and I might be able to tell you a lot more about dwarf galaxies than we know today. The James Webb telescope that they want to send up, which is going to be more than 10 times as powerful as the Hubble Space Telescope, it's going to answer those kinds of questions. And when it does, we're going to get a whole lot more evidence for design than we have today. Last question, then we got to wrap it up. Okay, the Andromeda Galaxy is the biggest galaxy in our local group. It's about 50% bigger than our Milky Way galaxy. And our Milky Way galaxy and Andromeda account for about 90% of the mass of the local group. So it's a highly unusual cluster of galaxies. But yeah, they're on the way to merging. And when they merge, they will both lose their spiral structure. But the good news is the merger won't take place for about another 4.5 billion years. So, and then we got a problem with the Large Magellanic Cloud going to merge with us first. Well, we can determine that we're on the way to absorbing another dwarf galaxy, the biggest of the dwarf galaxies in our local group, namely the Large Magellanic Cloud. But that's scheduled to take place 4 billion years from now. Now, there's also little tiny clusters of stars that we'll probably absorb between now and then. But, you know, I'm confident that Christ is going to solve the problem of evil before we have to worry about these merger events. So, and you know what's good news? We're in between merger events. Because when our galaxy would absorb a dwarf galaxy or a large globular cluster of stars, that's not good news for human life. The bacteria can handle it. We can't. So thank God we're in between merger events, which means the Lord has got to come before the next merger event. So, but I believe he'll come sooner than that. We got to wrap it up. Yeah, we're about 5 minutes over. I'm sorry. Father in heaven, how wonderful it is to be alive at a time when these amazing discoveries are taking place almost on a daily basis. And we thank you for the very hard work that dozens of astronomers put into analyzing this mountain of data that came back from the WMAP satellite. And we thank you, too, Lord, for their diligence. So they didn't just stop at trying to prove or disprove inflation. They went all the way and gave us several very outstanding tests of whether or not you exist and whether or not you created the universe for the benefit of humanity. Thank you, Lord, for the privilege of seeing this with our own eyes. And, Father, we pray that the scientists have made this discovery, that you would take the blinders off their eyes and they would recognize this isn't just amazing science, but it's amazing philosophy and amazing theology. May they receive the implications of this information, that you exist and you desire a relationship with them. And I pray, Father, you'd anoint everyone here in this class to be able to take this amazing good news that you've just given to us in these past few days and use it as a way to persuade people that you really are out there and that you care for us and you desire a relationship with us. May many people come to faith in Christ as a result. And Father, next week I pray you would give us rich insights into everything that your Bible has revealed to us about how you use the record of nature to demonstrate not only your existence, but your personal attributes and the means by which you want to bring us into a relationship with you, free from the penalty of our sin. In Jesus' name, amen.